Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Yunus and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Yunus. Thanks for joining us.
Today, we're going to be covering two chapters. The reason is chapter 13 is very short, and chapter 14 has some good meaty stuff to get into. So I think this is going to be a good show.
We would appreciate it if before you leave this show today, you like our video or our podcast, share it with your family, your friends, your neighbors, your business associates, the entirety of your social media networks so that we can grow the channel. And if you are already not a subscriber, this would be the ideal time to subscribe. That way, every time we upload a video, you'll be made immediately aware and as a result in the know.
And for those of you enjoying the podcast, please do share it with people, let them know about it, and make sure that you have listened to all the other chapters so that you are caught up on today's story. We're going to start with chapter 13, motorcycles. Again, Toby showed this last week, and I'll show it again. We have a vector image of a BSA motorcycle. Gold Star 500, is
BSA,
that right?
BSA Gold Star 500, yeah.
That's right.
They called it a thumper.
And the chapter 13 is called motorcycles. And the theme is, I like motorcycles. There are at least two ways to handle road trips on a motorcycle. One way is to count the miles and worry about everything that could possibly go wrong. The other way is to enjoy the stimulation of the physical and metaphysical experience. The former makes for a long and painful ride. The latter causes you to regret the ride being so short. I'm a physical / metaphysical rider, so riding time passes quickly for me. Whatever Carlos had done to the BSA, it improved the ride, the performance, and apparently the durability. The trail of white smoke I was accustomed to seeing behind me was gone, probably the result of more expensive piston rings, a smoother bore, polished valves, and upgraded gaskets. It didn't change the fact that it was still a thumper, a single-cylinder motorcycle with its unique exhaust note and body-numbing vibration. But I had no trouble maintaining 60 miles an hour and pushed 75 when needed. More than once, along a straight, flat, and lonely stretch of highway, I ran the bike up to 119 miles per hour. I ride southeast from Abiquiu on Route 84/285 through one of the many branches of the Carson National Forest to Santa Fe. I continue southeast until I pick up Route 66 at Klein's Corners and head east to my first stop in Tucumcari, New Mexico, a little over 200 miles and 3.5 hours of riding. I want to avoid riding through big cities and traffic on this trip, at least until I get to New Orleans. One of Uncle Carlos's songs pops into my head.
So this is called a corrida. It has a special beat and a special style. Y este es el corrida del caballo blanco que un día salió de Guadalajara. Of course, it goes on to tell the story of this white horse and rider that leave Guadalajara to warn a group of revolutionaries, Mexican revolutionaries, that the Federales were headed their way. Translated is, this is the corrida, the style of music, of the white horse who one day left Guadalajara. Ándale, caballo.
I shout into the wind while leaning a little further forward and twisting the throttle. Chapter 14, Tucumcari. I make Tucumcari by late morning. I could choose from a dozen different gas stations along Route 66, which cuts right through the center of town. I look for the least expensive, and I am pleased to see that I've arrived in the midst of a gas war. The vendors are advertising a price that is lower than the competing stations until one of them finally taps out or goes out of business. About halfway through town, I spot a large, hand-painted, red-on-white sign, cheapest gas in town, 11 cents a gallon. Good enough for me. I race ahead to the right turn into the station. The station property is lower than the road, and I go downhill as I turn. I push down on the rear brake to slow my descent, but as I near the bottom, a beat-up truck pulls in front of me, cutting me off before swinging around to my left. I have to grab the front brake hard, and much to my surprise and dismay, there is a pool of gravel ahead. Front brakes and gravel don't mix, so I know I'm going down. I'm traveling slow enough that I can break the fall with my right leg, enough to control it and minimize the damage. We go down on her right side and slide 3 or 4 feet. My right leg is already out from under the bike, so no head tattoo. Uncle Carlos's leather jacket takes the brunt of any damage. I punch the kill switch to shut the bike down. I have learned over my years of racing and falling not to jump up without first taking time to make sure everything is in working order. But I'm down in the middle of a business driveway, and I don't want to incur secondary damage by being run over by another beat-up truck. Before I can pick myself up, I'm surrounded by a dozen Hispanic men and women, all dressed similarly, blue bandana around their heads, Ray-Ban-style dark glasses, white t-shirts, blue jeans rolled at the cuff, and engineer's boots. The men are also wearing their colors, blue denim or leather jackets with their sleeves cut off, and their full-sized club patch on the back of the jacket. The design consists of the Zia symbol, the one on the New Mexico state flag, with a motorcycle wheel at its center. Above it, in a very stylish calligraphic font, it reads, Los Fatos, and below it, the phrase, MCABQ. They are the Los Fatos Motorcycle Club out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Fatos loosely translates to dudes. Two of them grab me under the arms and pull me to my feet, while three others gently lift the BSA into an upright position. The vato closest to me says, Hey man, are you okay? That damn truck was chale, ese. Chale is a New Mexican colloquialism that can translate into a variety of English words or phrases depending on the context. In this case, the translation is a real jerk. Like my friend Manolo, he speaks with the gentle accent of a New Mexican who is equally comfortable with Spanish and English. Yeah, I'm okay. I need to check the bike. I take off my hat and goggles and move toward the BSA. The mirror stanchion on the right side is bent, and there is a scratch on the front fender, but nothing that can't be polished out with a little work. One of the other vatos, noticing my youthful face, says, Hey man, he's just a kid. What the hell? That's followed by a mixed flurry of comments, some of them in English, some in Spanish. There's some laughter, and I hear one woman say, Pero que lindo, which causes a round of energetic giggling amongst the women. Because it means.
But he's cute.
I quickly glance over at the women who are dressed in tight jeans, t-shirts, and jackets. They are Latina and wearing makeup to accentuate their lovely features. It's a little uncomfortable to be the object of their flirtatious attention, especially in front of their biker boyfriends. I puff up my chest, shoulders, and chin with bravado to show I'm man enough to take it. Vato number one is wearing a couple of patches over the front pocket of his vest. One says Eddie, and the other says Prez. Eddie asks, Where you coming from, little bro? Abiquiu, I answer, and before he can ask, and I'm headed for New Orleans. This elicits a variety of reactions from the crowd, including nods of appreciation and discussion of my possible purpose. At the same time, someone realizes we are still in the path of large turning vehicles. Eddie wisely directs us to move to where their motorcycles are parked on the shady side of the gas station. They are riding custom bikes, Harley-Davidson baggers, some of them sportsters, but most of them hogs, the full-sized HDs. The paint jobs are beautiful in candy colors and metallics in every shade, with designs in multicolored flames and skulls, religious symbols, and lots of roses. Even in the shade, the chrome on them is blinding. Eddie lights a cigarette and offers it to me. I'm good. I wave it off, trying not to sound offended or offensive. He nods his head in understanding and raises the cigarette to his own lips to take a drag. The smoke escapes his mouth and nose as he speaks. So, what's in New Orleans, little bro? Mardi Gras. I start to explain what Mardi Gras is, but before I can get the words out, Eddie and the crowd respond with what sounds to me like positive reinforcement. The cacophony of Spanish and English verbiage coming from them confuses my ears. Mardi Gras, eh? Pretty bitchin'. He looks at his crew and offers, we should ride with a little vato, okay, no? It sounds like they all agree. I wonder how different this trip will be as a reluctant member of this group, instead of on my own as planned. Before Eddie can say anything else, one of the three vatos who had picked my bike up calls out to Eddie for his attention. When Eddie turns, the other shrugs his shoulders while pointing his hands at my bike in the universal gesture for, what do you want us to do with this cabrón BSA? Eddie thinks long enough to take another drag on his cigarette and commands, this is you.
Revisa el aceite y llena el tanque y la cantimplora. Check the oil. Fill his tank, the gas tank, and his canteen.
Without a word, they get to work as he turns back to me. Where are you going to stay while you're on the road? Eddie asks. I've got a pup tent and a sleeping bag and some food. How are you fixed for bread? He asks. Recalling Uncle Carlos and all his protective advice, I'm suddenly nervous to talk about how much cash I'm carrying in case they decide to charge me some extortionate fees for helping me with my bike. Hoping that playing dumb will get me out of this predicament, I pretend I don't know what he is asking. I didn't bring any, but I'll stop at the grocery store and pick some up. This elicits yet another round of laughter and giggling. No, bro, says Eddie. How are you fixed for lana? You know, dólares.
Dólares.
Dólares. Dólares.
Dólares.
Money. Quickly scanning the crowd, then Eddie's face. Quickly scanning the crowd, then Eddie's face for any sign of malice, I ask myself if this could be one of those situations that Uncle Carlos warned me about. Yet, they had been nothing but kind to me up to this point, so I cautiously remark, I'm pretty sure I have enough to get me there. I'll figure out how to get back later. He puts out his hand toward me and says, Dame tu gorra.
Give me your hat.
Slowly, I remove my cap and hand it to him. He tosses it over to one of the women, saying, Colección. And without question, she does as he suggests. She passes it around, and each of them takes some cash out of their blue jean pockets and tosses it into the cap. Surprise widens my eyes. For me? Eddie nods yes. Thank you very much. Don't thank me, little bro. Thank them. It's their lana.
Lana is a colloquialism for money, but it's cotton. Lana is another word for cotton.
That sets off yet another round of laughter. Considering their appearance, this is one happy, friendly, and helpful group of bikers. I make a mental note going forward on this journey to withhold judgment of people until I can figure out their intentions. When my cap returns, it is filled with dollar bills. He flips it quickly over my head. I can feel it sitting a little higher. The cigarette hanging from the corner of his mouth moves with his lips. Don't lose it. But you have to promise to come back and tell us the story of your ride. ¿Nos prometes?
Nos prometes.
I promise. I'm actually looking forward to it. One of the best parts of having an adventure is sharing the story afterward. Maybe when you come back, we'll make you a vato. You think you'd make a good vato? I feel like whatever comes out of my mouth next will create a make or break moment. I would be honored, and I would wear the colors with great pride. That is enough to win me a round of applause and a hug and a kiss on the cheek from one of the beautiful Latina women. Once again, I feel myself standing straighter to show off my manly maturity. Buena suerte, she says. Cuidado, Eddie warns her. You're too old for him. I want to disagree, but decide it's better to say nothing. Like my father always said, when somebody is giving you money, don't get in the way by talking too much. The other vatos roll my bike back to me. Está listo, one of them announces. I respond, muchas gracias. I zip up my jacket and pull the strap down from the bill of my cap to hook it under my chin. I don't want that cap to fly off before I have a chance to put the cash away in my hiding place. I go through the BSA's starting routine. It lights up on the third kick. Eddie reaches out to shake my hand. I have to cross my body with my right hand to grab his.
Que te vaya bien,
says Eddie. Thanks again. I appreciate all your help. Behind me, one of the young women calls out, ¿Cómo te llamas? I turn to see her gorgeous flashing eyes and full red lips once more, and in my best Spanish call out, Me llamo Miguel. Ay, Miguel, tan chulo, she purrs with a big smile and a wink of her eye. They hoop and wave. There is a mixture of goodbyes and good wishes. I smile at her, a little embarrassed, but appreciative of the teasing praise, even if she did just refer to me as a cute puppy. I wave back at them before kicking the BSA into gear and riding up the driveway onto the road. My next stop is about 2 miles outside of Tucumcari, where I take a couple of minutes to pull the cash out of my cap. I straighten it and roll it into something that I can stash away in the false oil tank that Uncle Carlos had added to the BSA for hiding valuables. I've got about 54 hours to get to Mardi Gras and a little more cash to add to my travel funds. Something, we've been talking for the past few weeks about mentorship and Uncle Carlos and how he provided everything he possibly could to make your trip go smoothly. And then first thing you do is come across this biker gang. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, if it was a movie, you would think, uh-oh, biker gang, bad news, something bad's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I know my son read the book. He said, it's just too easy for him. There's no difficulties he has to overcome. You know, the biker gang isn't mean. They help him out. They're good people, you know. Uh-huh. And I replied, well, this is what happened. This is a true story. This actually happened. And had they been mean, you would have said so. Uh-huh. But they were kind and helpful.
They were, at my young age, they were scary, right? Because I'd seen all kinds of biker gangs. They used to show up at the races that we'd go to, right? And some biker gangs would get drunk and rabble rouse, and others would get happy and just enjoy the day, right? And it didn't make, you know, there were white gangs, there were Chicano gang. I never saw a black gang back then. Of course, this was all in New Mexico, yeah. So it was rare. So I had a sense of gangs in both a positive and negative perspective. Now, I never belonged to any gangs. I had friends that I rode with, but we were nowhere near being gangs, and we didn't ride the big Harley-Davidson motorcycles. We rode Japanese motorcycles until I went to college when I brought the when I got the commando. So I didn't know what to expect, and that's why I was at least cautious, if not completely. I don't want them to know any more about me than I need to. But it warmed up right away, and I think part of that was because they had their ladies with them, and that always brings kind of a lightness to these groups, you know, having the women there, because they don't need to be offensive. They just, and forgive me, this was back then, their job was to look good, right, on the back of that, on the back of your already good looking motorcycle. So and there was a certain amount, I felt, of what I call New Mexico hospitality. You're, until you show a reason not to make your life difficult, there's no need for us to make your life difficult. And so that was a good lesson. And not as the hero's journey goes, it is not necessary that every event is a negative event to learn from. It can be a positive event to learn from. And I think what's important about this first interaction is it made me aware that not everything is bad, that there are good people in the world. And if you approach every interaction that you have from a positive perspective, there's a very good chance you're going to get a positive response. And I felt that's kind of what happened here. Plus, there was the lesson of, wow, that was good. It was fun. I made some friends, kind of. They invited me back to tell my stories and maybe make me a vato, not certainly on my BSA, but that it was a positive experience and that I took that positive experience with me. So, yeah, I've had it easy in that my uncle is going along with this. I've had it easy in that my first meeting with him. Well, you got to remember, I went down. This started with me going down in the gravel and getting some help. So it had kind of a negative start to it, but and then there was the intermediate of what's going on here. And it finishes with the warm, you know, kind of like, yeah, I didn't meet anything bad.
Well, and I think when you enter into a group who's already, you know, cohesive group like that, it can be very difficult. They're all, you know, their group, their people, they're not ready to just invite anybody into their group. But you were on a motorcycle. You encountered a truck that made you fall down on your bike. And I think because of that, they said, oh, immediately, oh, we need to help him because we've been there. Uh-huh. We have, you know, gotten waylaid by other drivers. That happens a lot to motorcycle riders, that people don't see them. They're not looking out for them. And, you know, they can get cut off. They can get run into. A lot of things can happen. So they have to look out for each other. And that's part of the reason they ride in groups, so that people will see them and, you know, will be aware of their surroundings and who's in them.
And that's all motorcyclists ask, is just be aware. Give us a little bit of space, right? Don't crowd us. We're not in a cage. That's what motorcyclists refers to car drivers as, cage drivers. There's no protection. You know, we're wearing helmets and safety gear, but the simple fact of the matter is we're not as protected as you. And in a match between a motorcycle and any kind of vehicle, the motorcycle is going to lose, period. That's just the way it is. And thus, the motorcycle is going to lose. And I think, as you said, every one of them had been in a situation, a similar situation, in the sense that they had gone down, they had hit gravel, they had had somebody cut them off. It may not be those exact set of circumstances each time, but you can't ride a motorcycle without eventually going down for some reason. Hopefully it's minor. Hopefully you don't scratch up your big hog, but they go down and they're even harder. I mean, there's actually a process you have to learn for picking up a heavy bagger like that. In order for you to get it back up so that you can mount it before you find out how much damage you've done. So they could relate. And I think the fact that I was, they were out of high school. You know, I don't know whether they were working or in college or whatever, but they were older than high school age. And so once I took off my goggles and my hat, they could see that I was just a kid in comparison to them. So I think whatever kindness came out from them was the result of the fact that they could empathize with the situation, and then further sympathize with somebody so young out there on the highway in Tucumcari. And I wasn't a local, you know, could have been from Tucumcari, I suppose, but it turns out I wasn't. I was young. I just went down, so why not help him?
So I think it's a good demonstration of not only being a mentor, but being like a group who's inviting somebody into their group, opening that up to you. They, oh, we should even ride with them, you know. Of course, you're like, I don't know you people.
This is my adventure. And I think there's probably a category of archetype in the hero's journey for the leader of a group. It wasn't because he wasn't necessarily a mentor. He wasn't trying to be a mentor. He wasn't giving me advice. He was just the leader of a group who was taking action. Now, there's two kinds of leaders. One is the antagonist. The other is the protagonist. He was a protagonistic leader. He was positive. He wanted to be on your side. And there's, again, you can learn as much from that, watching him operate with his own group, as you can from a mentor that's trying to teach you these things. So it's all part of that hero's journey. And I don't know, I think there are 25 archetypes that you can encounter in the reading of some hero's journey. I think this was one of those. This was the leader of a group archetype, and had followers. And you decide, you know, do I need him along the way, or can I borrow what he is offering me here? And there's some intent that you're always going to return the favor, maybe not immediately, but at some time in the future. And again, that's part of the archetypical story.
And we even mentioned it in the chapter, spelled it out, that Miguel decided not to judge people until he got to know more about them and their intentions for the rest of the journey. So that was that learning moment that he had, and that I guess everybody who was reading the book can follow along and learn that as well, that we shouldn't be judging people. Just because they're a motorcycle gang doesn't mean they are a certain way. Mm-hmm. You have to wait and see how they're going to treat you.
And when you think about it, who of us has not had that kind of experience where we encounter something and we assume the worst possible outcome without considering the possibility that it may not be the worst possible outcome? And I think once you have one, two, three, or four of those experiences, you start going into these social encounters in kind of a different way, more open to the possibility that it's not going to be negative, that it's going to be positive, and there are things to be gained on both sides as a result. On my side, I left comfortable. I left with a full tank of gas, my oil checked, and a full canteen, and a hat full of money. They left with stories about the kid that they helped, you know, and they helped it in a positive way that implies that they're good people. I could imagine, you know, some of the women getting home and telling stories to their friends about the little kid that they met, and they picked him up off the road and, you know, filled his tank with oil and gas and his canteen with water and collected money for him. I mean, that makes a good story for them too. It reinforces the fact on their side, they're good people. We're not bad biker guys. We did this for someone who was a complete stranger to us. And that's how it should be, because they're on their own hero's journey as well.
Have you had any other experiences you can think of where you thought that it was going to go bad, but then it turned around and went well?
I think the answer is yes. And I think it's the result of the fact that I was in a lot of foreign countries, and foreign is the key word there. And I was in a lot of what would be considered war zones. And so you do expect you expect that the situations, well, I'm going to say, how do I say this without stuttering through it? The expectation is that every situation you encounter will be negative until proven otherwise. And what you learn is that if you walk into it with the perception that every situation is going to be positive until proven otherwise, you're better off as you do these things. And the closest. Well, I can think of two examples. One was in the Balkans when I was being introduced to these officers that eventually I was going to have to interview. And some of those interviews were going to end up in the World Court, as some of them, not all of them, were convicted of war crimes. And I went into those only having read the news, seen the results of their actions and activities. And I went in thinking to myself, these are not good people. How can I ever get past the idea that these are not good people? And I had to kind of train myself because they weren't good people. They were very bad people. But I had to ignore that in order to get what I needed, which was these interviews. And we've told stories about some of the, you know, how weird some of those interviews got. Another one was in Afghanistan, where I had friends in the Afghan Department of Agriculture who happened to be related to President Karzai. And they thought, I thought this is going to be, and they were the ones introducing me to the poppy warlords. And each time, I mean, the poppy war, they call them warlords, right? They run poppies. They grow poppies for the sale of what's inside the poppies that turn into opium and heroin and all these other things. And so you go into that going like this, these are not good people. But you'd go down to what they call their mansions. They're usually, they're well-made adobe, sometimes two-story. I mean, they're very nice, but not what we'd call a mansion in New York City, right? And they greet you as if they've known you forever. They only know about you from the members of the Department of Agriculture. And they invite you to sit down for tea. And they, if they don't speak English, they will have a translator there for you, for them. And they'll talk about what you want to do and what you're trying to do and what you're trying to accomplish. And I discovered that when I told the story, when I said, I'm actually working for the Drug Enforcement Administration. My job is to trace the money that's going from Afghanistan to the Chinese military, and then where the poppy crop is going from Afghanistan to the Chinese military, and where that money is going, where those American dollars are going. And they'd say, "Oh, that is that's a very good story. Let me tell you what I know about it." And I'd say, "Wait, before you do that, let me turn my equipment on." And you never had a problem with light, of course, because you always, they all have these, you know, facing north windows, and that became your primary light. And you just poke up a microphone, turn on your camera, and they would talk. They would tell you all about it. They had no sense of that they were going to end up in prison over this but it was one of those situations that you walked into thinking, this can't possibly, this guy, they call him a poppy warlord. Mm-hmm. Right. There's a reason for that. Now, on the other hand, I did have a couple of situations when I didn't meet them and tell them what I was trying to do. They would start yelling at the translator and the person that brought me in, my fixer, and asking them what the hell they were thinking by bringing me here. And they'd kind of throw a fit. We'd finish drinking the tea with him looking at me like, I'm just going to wait until you blow up, you know. And then we'd have an interview. I don't ever remember walking into any one of those situations where I didn't walk out with an interview. And I think part of it was the fact that they were interested in telling their stories. And part of it was the fact that I wasn't dangerous. I wasn't a danger to them. I was just a documentary maker. So I've had those situations. This was, of course, one of the first because I was so young, but they went that way from the time I joined the military on.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate to say that we always seem to fear things that we don't know, the unknown. Mm-hmm. We fear the unknown, what we don't know what's going to happen, and assume the worst. But a lot of times, most of the time, when we just face that fear and go forward, it ends up being an interesting learning experience and can even be fun.
I think in some ways it is.
Yeah.
What if you walk away from it? But when you put your head on your pillow at the end of that day, you start, what runs through your head are all the things that could have gone wrong and how fortunate you were to have walked out of there. Mm-hmm. You know, it is, you do have to, you do think about them. You do, don't ignore those situations. And hopefully you learn from each one so that when you have to do it the next time, you make sure that it doesn't go bad. I remember in one case, I literally walked out. I walked out of it because I thought, this is really bad. And I told my fixer and my, who was also my translator, I said, would you please excuse us, let him know that we have to get back to headquarters. And he said it to the guy, and the guy was very offended. Like, you're leaving? We haven't even gotten started. And I told him, he said, he's yelling at us. Why would we want to stay when he's yelling at us? Mm-hmm. And the guy asked forgiveness. He said, I'm sorry. I just have to treat people that way. You know, he made an excuse for it, like, ugh, don't take me seriously. And then we sat down, had some more tea, and did an interview.
Did you learn that from your dad, the car salesman? You got to walk away and then they'll have you come back?
I don't think it applied. It was just like, this is a terribly uncomfortable situation. I'm not going, there's an AK-47 in the corner over there. And I'm not going to put me and my fixer slash translator, driver in this case, because he was performing all three functions. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to put us in a bad situation. Mm-hmm. And I told him, just say that. All right, if you don't care to do this, we'll leave. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And that upset him even further, because the impression was, his impression at that point was, he was not hospitable enough. He was so inhospitable that we decided the best thing to do was leave. And that was, to him, that was
an accurate description of what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And somehow or the other, he took that very personally, like, oh, wait, you know,
interesting.
I didn't mean that way. I just mm-hmm. have to, I'm a freaking poppy warlord, for God's sakes.
Yeah. Well, on a less scary note, I was worried about going home to visit my mom and having her become upset or, you know, beg me to stay with her or any number of things that may have happened. And thinking of that, you know, a week in advance, I made the decision to put together a photo album for her so we'd have something to look at, talk about, occupy her, rather than just, you know, having her be upset about, mm-hmm. you know, where she's at and how she doesn't want to be there or whatever. So I think that worked out for everybody, I think, that we all got to look at the photos together, and she stayed calm and interested, and it helped her have some clarity at that moment, you know. So I guess, you know, when we fear something, the best thing we can do is ask ourselves, what's the best outcome and how can I get to that? What can I do?
Yeah.
To make that happen, to make it the best possible outcome. Have you done that recently?
Well, no, but I do want to talk about that situation, because I think the fact that the first day you walked in with an album, and the second day we walked in with a big bouquet of flowers, and you immediately went back to the album and opened it up and put it in her lap, my, as I was watching all of this, I had the sense that it was confusing to her. Her expectation is that she was going to have another one of these visits where she tried to drag the visitor in to what she was experiencing and asked the visitor to get her out of that situation. And when you came up with the album, which I thought was a brilliant idea, it was like, oh, Okay, we'll look at the album, but when are we going to talk about me, you know?
Well,
and it never happened. She never got the chance. But right. It actually, if I remember correctly, Richard was talking to her And she said that she was tired, that she was ready for her nap or something like that. So it went from the expectation that the people were coming to break her out of prison, right, to going through the albums, giving her all the opportunity to ask all those questions about the pictures that she was seeing on the first day. And then the second day was the distraction of the flowers, followed by the albums and her getting tired. So I think, you know, part of it, I was surprised to see that Richard went back that afternoon, because I thought the timing is off. Like, you're not going to have anything, but he said it was okay. Mm-hmm. So I think the other thing too, is I'm interested to see if the kids go back to visit her and what she does without, because they're not going to be as creative as you. I don't mean they're not creative, but you had a plan. They're going to go in without a plan.
Yeah. Well, I taught preschool for several years, and I knew that you have to have, with preschoolers, you have to have something mm-hmm. planned. You have to have something to occupy them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they just kind of go crazy.
Yeah.
And you're just batting cleanup at that point. You're just like, how do I control the situation? So if you go into a situation already having some plan of control and what, you know, what the agenda is going to be, I guess that makes a big difference. And maybe that would be good advice for your daughter as she's going to be leading this roundtable.
This roundtable that she's going to do. Well, the number, when she said, you know, when I think of a roundtable, I think a moderator, 5 to 6 people. That to me is a roundtable. When she said it was 25, that to me is not a round table.
Yeah. I mean, if everybody talks even for 1 minute, that's 25 minutes.
Well,
that's
as I was describing the beginning to her, I said, well, once you have them sitting around the table or whatever it is, you start by having everyone introduce themselves and tell the others why they're there. Well, you can do that with 5 people in the group moderated group. You can't do that with 25 people.
No. Yeah, I think you got to find the leaders who want to talk.
Yeah.
And then the others are just going to have to listen.
if that, right.
Yeah.
The 25 people is not a panel.
No.
That if
that's
you're lucky, that's an audience. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So, but that's what we're going to talk a little bit more about.
An idea of how you're going to stay in charge and how everything's going to flow. And then I guess at the same time, you still have to be flexible if stuff comes up that you didn't plan on.
And I think the answer to the question that we started that part of the conversation with was, what other experiences have you had? Is the experience that I gained early on, especially in the military, is that if you don't plan, don't do.
Mm.
Right? That's the thing. If there's no planning, if you go into it blindly, only the worst can happen. If you're lucky, maybe. But 9 times out of 10, if there's no planning involved, you're not going to get, when I say the worst, that you're not going to get beat up by a bunch of motorcyclists. But 9 times out of 10, you're not going to get the result that you either needed or expected. So the objective is to plan so that you have the right mindset, the right emotional, you know, where you are emotionally, and the right equipment. Because in my business at the time, part of it was the equipment that I'd need to solve the problem. And so that requires planning, what you're putting in that box to take with you, how you're going to handle it, how you're going to use your translator or your driver or your fixer or the one person maybe doing all those things. So planning is the essence of making sure that the event produces the results that you expected. And
it seems to me that Miguel didn't plan.
No.
He was very lucky that his uncle kind of did the plan for him.
Uh-huh. He told him what to expect, and he had the benefit of having done it in the past. So the plan consisted of, well, I'm going to leave Abiquiu, and sooner or later I'll get to New Orleans, and hopefully it's before Mardi Gras is done. So he didn't have much other plan. Now, he had the benefit of being an experienced motorcycle rider. He had the benefit of knowing where he was going and how to get there. But I think part of what makes it the adventure is the lack of planning, because then it is an adventure. And you have to deal with the fact that it may not meet your expectations. I mean, he could have ended up in jail for 4 days in Texas, or he could have been, you know, tied up behind the gas station by the biker gang, and they rode off with this BSA 500. So planning, I think, may not have helped him in either of those situations, but at least he was aware of the potential. And I think the fact that he goes into these situations with a relatively open mind and curiosity, like, oh, what's going to happen here? I mean, they started by picking him up and picking the bike up. So, you know, it can't be too bad unless you, and your mind can go one of two ways. That guy is walking off with my uncle's motorcycle. I wonder where he's going with it. And this guy is picking me up and dragging me over into a group of people that are older, meaner looking than me and happen to be, you know, an organized motorcycle club. So it really depends what you do in response to any of those situations. I think if Miguel had reacted negatively, he might have caused them to react negatively, but I don't think it would have been any more than, okay, vato, get out of my way. Take your damn BSA or cabron BSA and get out of here, you know. But even the fact that he was driving a BSA, because that was the least, besides the Japanese motorcycles, the British motorcycles were their least favorite. They weren't an American motorcycle. They didn't want anything to do with it. And that's why he says, what do you want me to do? That one guy that comes up, what do you want me to do with that cabron BSA, you know? And the response was, you know, like, fill it up, put some oil in it, and fill his canteen with water. So I think it was very fortunate that that was his first, that his first encounter, exclusive of what happened with he and Carlos. His first on-the-road encounter was positive, could have gone either way, but turned out positive. And I think that's good in terms of experience.
Well, and as you said, the state of mind, the mindset matters, because you could have come away from that experience saying, you know, well, that truck knocked me down, and you could have just focused on that and been really angry,
throwing rocks at
even
the truck.
If these people had tried to help you, you could have been angry. They wouldn't have come up and, you know, tried to talk to you because you were just being angry. But instead you were open and listening and, open to their help.
Well, you also have to take into account that to this point in Miguel's life, he had the one event where his father was taken away from him, which is negative. But to some extent, he's led a regular, normal New Mexico kid's life, right? And he had the little minor adventures of going out to the hills in Santa Fe and camping out for the weekend on his own. He had the riding with the Huckabees, you know, going down to races all over New Mexico, you know, to dirt track and road races. So it wasn't like he was inexperienced in the ways of the world. I think he was probably inexperienced in the ways of the world that he would encounter once he gets to New Orleans. Like, up until that point, if you were to exclude the fact that he loses his father at the age of 11, he hasn't had a bad life. Even though, you know, he's mad at his mom for sending him off to boarding school. That might have been one of the best things that happened to him in terms of how it affected the rest of his life. So he hasn't had bad negative experiences until he runs into the society of New Orleans that he happened to run into. And, you know, it starts, I don't want to give any secrets here, but it starts with him meeting a young, beautiful woman that happens to be a prostitute. So you already know that's coming from a place that's not good. The second place it goes into is one of the biggest bars along the wharf, you know? So he's already put himself in a situation that has more potential to turn negative than all the previous situations he has experienced in his life. So, but you have to, you're going to have to stick with us until we get to that part.
Yeah, we wanted to combine chapter 13 and 14 because it's basically it's just talking about being on the motorcycle and then meeting up with the gang. And I put on the title on the thumbnail, the picture in the thumbnail, one of the gang, because that's how they treated Miguel. They're like, oh, yeah, we should go with you. Or, wouldn't you like to be a vato? You know, they were very open to the idea of Miguel hanging out
joining
with them.
The club. Yeah.
So they must have felt like this is like our little brother. This is somebody who.
That's how I felt they were treating.
They recognize.
Yeah, our little bro.
Yeah.
Plus, MC is motorcycle club. They don't think of themselves as a gang. It's the outside world that thinks of them as a gang. They have president. They have a vice president. They have the road guards. You know, there's a hierarchy that goes along with us. So. And what counts is how clean you keep your bike and how good looking your chava is, you know.
All right. Is there anything else you wanted to add for today's story?
No, I think it was a good story. I didn't realize I'm going to have to talk to Jared and say, wait a minute. Okay, so we had a couple. Not everything in life is negative. You can learn from the positive events as well.
Well, he just thought your charmed existence was. You know, there's no problems, then how do you have a book when you don't have any
when you don't
conflict
have any,
or
right.
anything?
You do have conflict, but we'll get there.
But we were trying to stick to the truth at the same time.
Well, the other thing too is he's a 15-year-old kid. How much trouble can he get into? You know, he's not in combat in Vietnam yet, so
yeah. All right. Well, that was chapters 13 and 14 for today. And Miguel is on his adventure. And I hope you'll join us again next week. And he'll continue his adventure into Texas and see what he encounters there.
You ready to say goodbye?
Yep. That's all we have for today.
And we'll see you next week.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story because your story matters.